afternoon. It's Friday, January 22nd, 2021, and time to read from today's Sioux City Journal. I'm Sandy Barron. I'm a volunteer, and I'm pleased to be able to bring you the news today. We'll start with the mini editorial from the front page. This comes to us from Keith Pease of Sioux City. No one knelt during the national anthem. Hundreds of United States flags flew proudly at full mast, and "Under God" was included in the Pledge of Allegiance. What a beautiful sight. President Biden closed by saying, "Before God and all of you, I give you my word, I will always level with you." That said, I wonder if he'll be able to keep the country above party. I'm rooting for him. We'll need it. Again, this comes to us from Keith Pease of Sioux City. And the major story on the front page is entitled "Vaccinations Expanded." This comes to us from Dolly A. Butts of the Sioux City Journal. From Sioux City, Siouxland District Health Department anticipates being ready to administer COVID-19 vaccine to priority group 1B by early next month. The announcement of the next stage comes amid a lag in the vaccination of the initial priority group in Woodbury County, frontline healthcare providers and staff and residents of long-term care facilities. Siouxland District Health Department Deputy Director Tyler Brock said in an email that he expects vaccinations of Group 1A healthcare providers to wrap up in the next week or two. Then he said the health department would be ready to move on to the 1B populations by February 1. The 1B phase includes individuals 75 and older and others who are at high risk of exposure, including correctional facility staff, people who are incarcerated, PK through 12, pre-kindergarten through grade 12 school staff, meatpacking and manufacturing production line workers, first responders, and government officials and their staff. It is taking us longer to get through the healthcare providers in Woodbury County, because there are so many more, Brock said. We are also covering many providers in Nebraska and South Dakota because they occasionally work in Iowa because of hospital rounds, surgeries, urgent care, shifts, etc. As of Tuesday, 3,559 Woodbury County residents had been vaccinated, according to Iowa Department of Public Health. Overall, 6,046 doses of the vaccine had been administered in the county, according to the state data. The higher numbers takes in residents of other counties who had been vaccinated by Woodbury providers. The number of residents receiving the vaccine in Woodbury, Iowa's sixth largest county, trails the comparable totals in the state's other most populous counties, according to a journal analysis of the state data. As of Tuesday, Polk, number one in population, Lynn, number two, Scott, number three, Johnson, number four, Black Hawk, number five, Story, number seven, and Dubuque, number eight. The total number of vaccinated were 21,489, 11,894, 13,370, 6,172, 5,654, 5,591, and 4,276, respectively. Some counties neighboring Woodbury have also been more advanced plans to vaccinate in the next priority group. Last week, Dakota County Health Department announced that residents 65 and older could get on a waiting list to receive the vaccine, while this week, Floyd Valley healthcare officials released dates for 1B priority group vaccination clinics in Plymouth County. Obviously, it's natural to compare neighboring counties to each other, but there are large differences that make those comparisons difficult, said Brock, who noted, quote, significant differences, end quote, between the number of healthcare professionals in Woodbury, Plymouth, and Dakota counties. When Woodbury County moves to the 1B phase of vaccination, it will take many weeks to fully cover all of those people, according to Brock. And everything is obviously dependent on how much vaccine we get, which we don't know until about 1 week before it shows up at our door, he said. People have been very patient through this process, and we appreciate their continued patience as we make our way through this challenging time. Students embrace Biden's tone, and this article is accompanied by a picture showing Kevin Lopez, a senior at Storm Lake High School, watching a replay of President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris's inauguration ceremony Wednesday during a current events class. This comes to us from Brett Hayworth of the Sioux City Journal from Storm Lake, Iowa. In becoming the 46th president, Joe Biden, in his inauguration speech, called for unity as he aimed to take on the crises, a tone that a diverse class of high school students in Northwest Iowa quickly seized as a key takeaway that makes them hopeful for the years ahead. Students in Kevin Lipp's current events course at Storm Lake High School watched Wednesday's inauguration. In separate interviews, the students quickly brought up the Biden message of unity and inclusion. Senior Kevin Lopez said he liked how Biden, vice president under Barack Obama, cited the necessity of wanting to end the divisions between rural and urban Americans and red versus blue political states. Unity, definitely unity, he emphasized that a lot, Lopez said. He had a confident and positive tone. I know the forces that divide us are deep and they are real, but I also know they are not new. Our history has been a constant struggle between the American ideal that we are all created equal and the harsh, ugly reality that racism, nativism, fear, demonization have long torn us apart, Biden said. This is our historic moment of crisis and challenge, and unity is the path forward, and we must meet this moment as the United States of America. Freshman Jose Hernandez said, since Biden is talking about unity a lot, I think he wants to deliver on his promise. Lipps had students watch 90 minutes of footage that had no news commentary along with it to give an unvarnished view of the speech and other elements. Lipps gave the students three options for the project. One, to give a factual news recap with the typical who, what, where, and so on. Two, an emotional storytelling version that focused on visuals and the mood of the event. Or lastly, a critical opinion where pupils could say whether they agreed or disagreed with the speech or add what they think Biden overlooked. I can see the seniors are into it, Lipps said. Lipps told the students that inaugural addresses are notable because historians look back at the speeches to help determine if presidents later met stated goals. Senior Anna Racy thought it was a good exercise and within an hour had some takeaways written for her storytelling version. Rassassi said Biden was correct in saying Americans were celebrating a notable step for democracy, not his personal victory. The tone in his voice, it was very promising, she said. By virtue of his November election win over incumbent Republican President Donald Trump, Biden took the oath Wednesday at U.S. Capitol that had been battered by an insurrectionist siege just 2 weeks earlier. Biden said that amid this winter of peril, there is much to restore, much to heal, much to build, and much to gain. Storm Lake, the Buena Vista County seat of about 10,600 people, is a racially diverse community. Minorities represent over 80% of the students in the city's public schools. Rassassi, who plans to attend the University of Iowa, Gomez and Gonzalez, all said the summer 2020 nationwide riots fueled by people seeking racial justice really impacted them. They independently all stated support for the Black Lives Matter movement and said scaling black racism is one of the top three most pressing national issues. Hernandez says he wants to see equality in all ways, while Lopez said tolerance for people of all races has been hampered by the messages of Trump. Lopez, who voted for Biden, mentioned the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol as proof. It put me in shock. The big thing I got from the riot was how if it was a different colored people how the police response would have been different, Lopez said. What I really care about is the Black Lives Matter movement, the white supremacists, and the pandemic. Biden hit on all of those, Rassassi said. All three Storm Lake students said without the current events course, they wouldn't have watched such a lengthy clip of the inauguration. They said they would have still seen some of it, true to their generation's best, via smaller video snippets on Instagram or Twitter. Like adults, the students also had opinions of the attire worn by the inauguration participants and the popular singers who had roles. Lady Gaga did impress me. All the singers impressed me with their voices, Rassassi said. She threw in a mention of Garth Brooks, who created a tender moment when asking the people to sing along to Amazing Grace. Gomez talked about Lady Gaga's performance of the national anthem and Jennifer Lopez's rendition of Woody Guthrie's standard, This Land Is Your Land. Gomez said he would need a few more hours to finish his project, while a seed for 2024 and forward was planted for Rassassi. I feel the next inauguration, I'll watch it, she said. The online poll question for today is, who do you think will win the AFC championship game? Yesterday's poll question was, which former president were you most interested in seeing at the inauguration? George Bush received 56% of the vote, Barack Obama received 41%, and Bill Clinton received 3%, with the total number of people voting as 34. And the frequently asked question of the day, what is employee of the quarter? I saw a sign in front of the journal that said that. And the journal staff responds, members of the Sioux City Journal staff are nominated by their fellow employees for the honor. Often they're named for something that exceeded expectations and helped make the company even better. Among the perks is a parking space near the front door. 10 more COVID-19 deaths reported. This comes to us from Dolly A. Butts of the Sioux City Journal. From Sioux City, 8 Siouxland counties reported 10 additional COVID-19 related deaths on Thursday. According to Iowa Department of Public Health data, Woodbury and Dickinson counties added 2 deaths to their total, while Lyon, Osceola, Clay, Plymouth, Buena Vista, and Monona each tallied 1. The deaths are rising, even though positivity rates and hospitalizations have stabilized in Siouxland, since deaths are a lagging indicator of the pandemic. Siouxland District Health Department confirmed 24 new cases of the novel coronavirus in Woodbury County on Thursday, but not the 2 new deaths. Based on state statistics, the county has a 14-day COVID-19 positivity rate of the 11.2% and 179 total deaths. District Health reported that 30 patients with the virus were hospitalized at either Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center or Unity Point Health, St. Luke's, down 2 from Wednesday. Of those patients, 19 were hospitalized for treatment of COVID-19, another 11 people in the hospital have the virus but are hospitalized for other reasons. Of the total, 16 are Woodbury County residents. Iowa House rejects call for mask mandate. This comes to us from James Q. Lynch of the Journal Des Moines Bureau. From Des Moines, House Republicans have refused to adopt rules requiring face coverings at the Capitol or to allow members to participate in committee meetings and floor votes from outside the State House during the coronavirus pandemic. Republicans who control the House and the Senate said Thursday current protocols that recommend but don't require that people wear face masks are working. I have seen very few people who are not either utilizing social distancing or wearing a mask even when they are able to social distance, House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican of New Hartford, said. However, Representative Brian Mayer, Democrat of Des Moines, warned, it's only a matter of time before something happens. Already a person reported testing positive for COVID-19 after being at the Capitol last week. Mayer applauded the Republican leaders for steps taken to accommodate legislators and the public in the process of creating legislation. But we are falling short, he said. Meyer offered a handful of amendments to require masks everywhere in the Capitol complex, or at least require them in the House committee and subcommittee meetings. He also sought to change House rules to allow members to participate in meetings and vote telephonically or by other electronic means. We can do it better, Meyer said. We can allow for people to have comments. We can allow for members to vote remotely. We can allow for interested parties to come into this building and feel safe or go online and make their comments heard. In the end, his amendments were voted down and the session rules adopted without any of the measures he sought. House Resolution 3 was approved 55-35. Also Thursday, the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, filed an OSHA complaint against the legislative leadership for their, quote, reckless disregard for the safety, end quote, of people who work and visit the Capitol. It appears they do not really care about the safety and well-being of everyone that comes into the Capitol, Charlie Wishman, Iowa Federation president, said about the lack of a mask mandate. Some state legislatures have enacted mandatory mask policies or have delayed their sessions because of COVID-19. GOP leaders said they hadn't seen the complaint, but stood by the protocols in place. The process we have in the Senate is working, Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican of Ankeny, said. Unlike House members, senators are allowed to participate virtually in legislative meetings and work in the chamber when needed, but otherwise can work from their office or home. We just have to continue to monitor, he said. Although the House has rules that cover lawmakers' attire, for example, Grassley questioned whether a mask mandate would be enforceable. What would the recourse be, he said? Would they expect the state patrol to come in and remove a member of the public or a member of the caucus? If a member is not properly attired, he said, they would not be removed but would not be recognized to speak on the House floor. In seeking the rules change, Democrats pointed out that several government agencies, such as the Transportation Commission, conduct virtual meetings, including voting. The legislature's Administrative Rules Committee and the Legislative Council conducted meetings and voted remotely during the time between the 2020 session and the current session. Arraignments set for 2 of 3 men implicated in New Year's homicide. This comes to us from Mason Doctor of the Sioux City Journal. From Sioux City, arraignments have been scheduled for 2 of 3 young men implicated in a January 1st homicide at the residence in Morningside. Christopher Morales, 19, has arraignments set for January 25th and January 27th, while his brother Carlos Morales, age 18, has an arraignment set for February 2nd, according to court documents. Bond for Christopher Morales has been set at $1 million, while Carlos Morales's bond is $500,000. Both are held in Woodbury County Jail, along with a third man arrested in connection with the case, 18-year-old Anthony Bauer. No arraignment date has been yet set for Bauer, whose bond is at $500,000. A no-contact order against Bauer was filed in connection with the case last week. The Public Defender's Office has withdrawn as counsel for all three cases. The Council Bluffs Public Defender's Office has been appointed as counselor for Carlos Morales and Bauer, while Christopher Morales is being defended by Sioux City Attorney Craig H. Lane. A prosecutor alert document filed in Christopher Morales' case denotes his reputation as a known gang member with numerous previous warrants for failure to appear in court. Each are facing charges, including first-degree murder, going armed with intent, and counts of reckless use of a firearm, among other charges. All three would face mandatory life sentences without parole if found guilty of first-degree murder. Christopher Morales pleaded not guilty Thursday to charges of delinquent in possession of a firearm, interference with official acts, and carrying a dangerous weapon. The shooting transpired just after midnight January 1st. The three men allegedly forced a person to enter a residence at 2637 Walker Street, where a house party with 20 to 25 people was underway. They then opened fire on the house, firing at least 27 shots with a 9mm handgun and an assault-style rifle, according to court documents. It is not known who fired which weapon. 18-year-old Mia Alexis Kritis was killed in the shooting, while three others were hospitalized with gunshot injuries. Iowa prepares second phase of COVID-19 vaccination distribution while first phase is slowed. This comes to us from Aaron Murphy of the Johnston Journal Des Moines Bureau. From Johnston, hundreds of thousands more Iowans are about to become eligible to receive COVID-19 vaccine, but demand for the vaccine will outweigh supply early in the process, state officials said Thursday. Iowa will begin the second phase of its vaccination program the week of February 1st, at which time Iowans who work in law enforcement, emergency response, K-12 education, and child care will become eligible to receive the vaccine, as will any Iowans ages 65 or older. However, the number of newly eligible Iowans, more than 660,000, the state estimates, will outnumber the number of vaccine doses available, according to state officials who asked for patients from the public. You can see this is no small undertaking, Governor Reynolds said Thursday during a news conference at Iowa PBS studios. Iowans will need to be patient. The vaccines will be coming. It's just going to take some time. The state is completing the first phase of its vaccine rollout, which Reynolds acknowledged has been going slower than expected. She said an insufficient allotment of vaccine doses has slowed the process of getting vaccines to nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. Reynolds said she has been assured that the first doses for that first phase will be completed by the end of the month, with the second doses required to be administered 3 or 4 weeks after the first. That means the first phase would be totally completed by the end of February. Reynolds said the state receives roughly 19,500 vaccine doses per week and that the state immediately distributes those to ensure they get to Iowans as quickly as possible. She said Iowa is receiving fewer doses per population than most states and is working with the state's congressional leaders to learn why. It's going to take some time. There's just not a lot of doses being allocated, she said. Reynolds said, despite that slow rollout of the first phase, the state will begin the second phase in February. She said the prospect of new vaccines coming to the market and working with a new federal administration could boost the number of doses allotted in coming weeks. The second phase of the state's vaccine distribution plan is broken into 5 tiers. The first tier includes all Iowans 65 years or older, plus workers in law enforcement, emergency response, K-12 education, and child care. The second tier includes workers in food processing, manufacturing, agriculture, and other essential jobs where social distancing at work is difficult. The second tier also includes any Iowans living with disabilities in home settings. The third tier includes any workers in congregate settings not covered by the previous tier, and state lawmakers and state government staff at the Iowa State Capitol. The fourth tier includes health and safety inspectors, and the fifth tier includes staff and inmates at correctional facilities. We know everyone wishes this would move faster, Kelly Garcia, interim director of the state public health department, said during the news conference. The demand for this phase is tremendous, and supply remains constrained. Iowans who will soon become eligible to receive the vaccine will be notified by a number of possible sources, most likely their employer, local pharmacy, or local public health department. Here are a few briefs from around the area. From Dakota City, Nebraska, the Dakota County Board of Commissioners on Monday are expected to make an appointment from a list of 4 people to fill a vacancy for the county treasurer position. The treasurer vacancy occurred because former treasurer Bob Giese was elected to a seat as a county commissioner in November. Giese was sworn in early January when the state mandated clock of 45 days began for the commissioners to fill the position via appointment. The meeting will be held at 1 p.m. at the Dakota County Courthouse in Dakota City. Dakota County Auditor Joan Spencer reported a county board member committee on January 14th for a second time and met with some of the candidates who were interested in becoming treasurer. Spencer said the committee has recommended 1 of 4 people to become the treasurer, with the list including Don Bouquet of South Sioux City, Jolene Goebbels of Hubbard, Jane Keiches of Jackson, and Robert F. Kratke of Dakota City. The treasurer's office handles tasks that include property taxes payments, which vehicle and boat registrations, driver's license exams, and unclaimed property. Giese, a Democrat from South Sioux City, won several terms as treasurer, including most recently in 2018 when he had no opposition. Giese was a state senator until resigning to ultimately win the treasurer post in 2010. From Alcester, South Dakota, Union, a 68-year-old man, died Tuesday from injuries sustained in an all-terrain vehicle accident that occurred Monday near Alcester. According to the South Dakota Department of Public Safety, Thomas Saylor of Alcester was driving the 2009 Arctic Cat ATV that was westbound on 300 First Street near the intersection with 478th Avenue when he lost control. The vehicle partially rolled and came to rest in the north ditch. Saylor was the sole occupant of the ATV, and he was thrown from the vehicle and suffered life-threatening injuries. He was transported by ambulance to Hayward, Iowa Hospital, and then was flown to a Sioux Falls hospital. South Dakota's Highway Patrol said an investigation into the crash is continuing. And finally, from Onawa, Iowa, the trial for an Onawa teenager charged in the shooting death of another teenager has been rescheduled. District Judge Dwayne Hoffmeyer this week rescheduled the trial of J. Lee Newbaum to May 18th. The trial was originally set to start in March. It is nearly half past the hour, and time now to turn to the obituaries. The first one comes to us from Fruita, Colorado. Dennis Lloyd Finneran from Fruita, formerly of Craig, Colorado, died Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020, at his home after a year-long illness following a stroke. Dennis was formerly from Sioux City. Per his request, cremation has taken place, and a celebration of life will happen this summer at our favorite camping area. He was born March 26, 1955, to Lyle and Doris Finneran in Sioux City. He graduated from South Sioux City High School in 1973. He worked for the Milwaukee Railroad after high school. On April 3, 1976, he married Marilyn Andrews of Moorhead, Iowa. They moved to Craig in 1979, and he worked at the Haywarden Power Plant until his retirement in 2015. While his family was growing up, they enjoyed many years of camping, golfing, archery, and other outdoor activities. After retirement, he enjoyed traveling, visiting several national parks. From Sioux City, Rita Angela Albrecht. Rita Angela Redding Albrecht, 95 of Sioux City, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, January 20th, at Northern Hills Assisted Living with family and the great staff. Her family was able to visit her on a video meeting from around the world right before her passing. Due to travel restrictions, with her family being located in so many distant places, the family will have services and a celebration of life as soon as everyone can gather in Sioux City. Arrangements are being made by Christy Smith Funeral Home in Sioux City, with an online guest book if you would like to leave your message to the family. The family will have a service when we are able to gather to celebrate her life. She was born in Defiance, Iowa, to Augustine and Francis Redding. During World War II, she was a Rosie Riveter, after which she met her husband, Theodore Ted Albrecht, in Omaha when he sold her a pair of shoes and became smitten with her. They were married for 59 years before his passing in 2008. They moved from Omaha to Sioux City in 1952. Her priority was always her family. She was a dedicated member of the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church for 69 years and was a member of the Catholic Daughters and was always active in her church circle. In lieu of flowers, contributions can be made to Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church or Hospice of Siouxland. We want to thank the wonderful staff at Heritage Northern Hills Independent and Assisted Living, where Mom lived for the past 10 years. They took care of all of her needs and had particular loving care from Rhonda, Megan, and Adam. Also, the family wants to thank Mike Keating, Mary Motz, Dennis and Joni McWilliams, Chuck Hansen, and David Stedma, Rita Potter, for all their kind acts that enabled our family to know that Rita was in good hands with the distance between us and Sioux City. From Davenport, Iowa, Lynn Broderson Cochran of Davenport passed into the afterlife on Tuesday, January 12th. A private service will be held January 23rd at Wirt's Funeral Home. A live stream will be held on Facebook on the Wirt's Funeral page at 10:30 a.m. on January 23rd. Online condolences can be made to the family by visiting her obituary at www.weertsfh.com. Lynn was born December 31st, 1968, to Ann Norcott and Hans V. Broderson, Jr. in Haywarden. She graduated from North High School in Sioux City. She received her B.A. in History, magna cum laude, from Cole College in Cedar Rapids in May of 1991. Lynn received her M.A. degree from the University of Notre Dame in Modern European History in August of 1992, her Ph.D. in Education, Leadership and Policy Studies emphasis was granted from Iowa State University in 2008. She was a member of Phi Beta Kappa and Mortar Board. On March 17, 2017, she was united in marriage to Douglas Cochran in Newton, Iowa. Lynn was a passionate professional who served community colleges and higher education for over 30 years. She served Western Iowa Tech Community College, Metropolitan Community College in Omaha, Central Lakes College in Brainerd, Minnesota, University of Wisconsin-Richland, North Iowa Area Community College in Mason City, Iowa, Iowa State University Extension, and most recently as the president of Scott Community College in Davenport. Memorials in Lynn's name may be made to Scott Community College Foundation in Lynn's name to support her student enrichment projects at www.eicc.edu/SCC Foundation or to Wagon Train Terrier Rescue in Omaha, Nebraska. From Battle Creek, Iowa, Lori L. Peterson. Lori L. Peterson, 53, of Battle Creek, passed away on Sunday, January 17th at a local hospital. No services will be held at this time. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. The Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home of Battle Creek is in charge of the funeral arrangements, and condolences may be sent online to www.christensenvanhouten.com. Lori Lene Peterson, the daughter of Clifford and Lillian Miller Reed, was born on January 10, 1968, in Battle Creek. Lori attended Maple Valley High School and then studied at Iowa Community College in Emmitsburg. On October 21st, 1996, Lori married Scott Peterson in Battle Creek. From Turin, Iowa, Paul Peterson Jr. Paul Peterson Jr., 83, of Turin, passed away Monday, January 18th, at a local hospital. A public visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Sunday at the Rush Family Chapel in Ottawa. Social distancing measures must be followed. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, masks are required for the visitation and service. A private family service will be held at the Rush Family Chapel in Ottawa, with Pastor Linda Boggs officiating. Burial will follow in Belvedere Cemetery, rural Turin. Arrangements are under the direction of Rush Family Care Service in Ottawa. Condolences may be left online for the family at www.rushfamilycareservice.com. Paul was born August 1, 1937, on the farm near Turin, the son of Paul and Oma Mann Peterson. He grew up in the Turin area and graduated from Castaigne High School in 1956. Paul and Patsy Peterson were united in marriage on March 9, 1957, in the Castaigne Community Church in Castaigne. The couple were lifelong farmers on their family farm near Turin. Paul enjoyed building birdhouses and the grandchildren. He took time and cared for his son, Roger, and wife, Patsy. He was a member of the RLDS Church in Moorhead, Iowa. Paul and Patsy were charter members of Monona Services, currently Crossroads of Western Iowa, and volunteered for their summer camp every year. From Marcus, Iowa, Shirley D. Rose, and that's R-O-E-S-E, Shirley D. Rose, R-O-E-S-E, 86, of Marcus, passed away Tuesday, January 19th, at Heartland Care Center in Marcus. A private family graveside service will be held. The family will have a public memorial service at Faith Lutheran Church at Marcus at a later date in the spring. The Greenwood Schubert Funeral Home in Marcus is assisting the family with arrangements, and online condolences may be sent to the family at www.greenwoodfuneral.com. Shirley D. Rose, the daughter of Orville and Lillian Andrews Heinrichs, was born February 28, 1934, in Pomeroy, Iowa. She was baptized and confirmed at Mission Covenant Church in Pomeroy. Her childhood years were spent on the farm, where she attended country school through eighth grade. She then attended and graduated from Pomeroy High School in 1952. After high school, she attended and graduated from Buena Vista University in Storm Lake. On January 27, 1956, Shirley was united in marriage to Gordon Rose of Pomeroy. She taught school in Peterson, Iowa, Manson, Iowa, and Marcus, where she remained until her retirement. Shirley was an active member of Faith Lutheran Church in Marcus. She enjoyed volunteering and helping with the church guilds. From Sioux City, LeJune M. Gray. LeJune M. Gray, aged 76, died Tuesday, January 19th. Private services will be January 25th. Meyer Brothers Malone Morningside Chapel is in charge of arrangements. Burial will be after the service at Memorial Park Cemetery. From Vermilion, South Dakota, Patricia Arlene Frazee, age 69, of Vermilion, passed away Friday, January 8th at Sanford Hospital in Vermilion. The celebration of Patricia and Danny's lives will be at 2 p.m. on Saturday at First Baptist Church in Vermilion, with Pastor Elmer Sandy Aker officiating. Visitation will be an hour prior to the service at the church. Cober Funeral Home of Vermilion has been entrusted with the services. Condolences may be posted online to www.coberfuneralhome.com. Patricia was born March 11, 1951, in Wynot, Nebraska, to Claude Streeter and Wilma Bennett, but due to difficult times was lovingly raised by Wilbur and Blanche Bursell of Vermilion. Pat attended school in Vermilion. Pat worked at Zenith in Sioux City and Electro Magic in Vermilion until becoming a caregiver to Jerry Kudelik until her retirement, but continued to provide a loving care to everyone who knew her. From Dakota Dunes, Marvel Tootie Mozak Edwards, 81, of Dakota Dunes, passed away Wednesday, December 23rd, at Mercy Hospital after complications from open-heart surgery. She entered into God's hands peacefully, surrounded by her loving family. Services will be held at 1 p.m. on Monday at Sunnybrook Community Church and will be available online at the Sunnybrook website. A celebration of life will be held this summer. Arrangements are under the direction of Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Online condolences may be expressed at www.meyerbroschapels.com. Tootie was born January 22, 1939, in Sioux City to Ralph and Gertrude Palmer Crawford. She graduated in 1957 from Bishop Heelan High School in Sioux City. After graduating, she married Ron Mozak and had four children. Ron passed away in August of 1987. In September of 1995, Tootie entered into marriage with Tom Edwards in Sioux City. In addition to being a loving and devoted mother and grandmother, Tootie spent much of her life as an entrepreneur and small business owner. The customer interactions this provided suited her servant heart perfectly. Tootie's kind and gentle nature created long-lasting friendships and left imprints on the hearts of everyone she met. She became a hockey enthusiast while watching her grandsons play. From Sioux City, Ray Miller. Ray Miller, 43, of Sioux City, passed away on Monday, January 4th, due to complications of COVID-19. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Mobile is in charge of arrangements. From Sloan, Iowa, Ruth Eileen Topf, that's T-O-P-F, age 97, died Sunday, January 17th. Services will be January 22nd at 10:30 a.m. at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Salix. That means by the time this is being read, the services would have been this morning. Masks and social distancing were required. Burial was in St. Joseph's Catholic Cemetery, Salix. Visitation was January 21st from 5 to 7 p.m. at the church. Arrangements were with the Rush Family Care Service in Ottawa. From Emerson, Nebraska, LaDonna Mae Monick Sebade, age 88, died Wednesday, January 20th. Services will be January 25th at 11 a.m., St. Paul's Lutheran Church of Emerson. Burial will be in the Rose Hill Cemetery of Emerson. Visitation will be January 25th from 9:30 to 11 at the church. Arrangements are with Munderlow Smith Funeral Home in Emerson. And from Sioux City, David A. Siebold, Sr. David A. Siebold, Sr., 74, died Tuesday, January 19th. Services will be January 25th at 10 a.m., Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Burial will be after the service at Graceland Park Cemetery. Visitation will be January 24th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the funeral home. George Knobb from Sioux City. George Knobb, N-A-A-B, age 76, died Wednesday, January 20th. Arrangements pending with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. And finally from Sioux City, Tracy Magallanes, M-A-G-A-L-L-A-N-E-S, age 56, died Wednesday, January 20th. Arrangements are pending with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff. We turn now to the health and family section, and we'll read an article entitled A Beginner's Guide to Starting Therapy. What to know about the process plus advice on getting started. Considering what we're living through, we're all probably due for some therapy. If you've never done therapy before, the concept can seem a little daunting. Are you just sitting in a room for these days on a video call with a stranger telling them your darkest secrets? Well, yes, a stranger who knows to ask specific questions, look for specific patterns in your behavior, and teach you more productive ways to manage your life. What is therapy? Basically, it's like having a deep conversation with a close friend where you only talk about yourself, said Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist and the founder of Therapy for Black Girls. The difference is that the person is trained. So unlike talking with your friend, there are certain things that we're listening for, Harden Bradford said. We're paying attention to your body language. We're paying attention to some things that someone who's not trained as a therapist is probably not paying attention to. It's an opportunity to talk through what you're experiencing and how you're feeling in a place that's free of judgment with someone who is purely listening to help. It's a time devoted entirely to you where you can process stresses and talk through confusing or overwhelming emotions you might be experiencing. There's no such thing as being too smart for therapy to be effective or having issues that are too big or too small to be addressed. There are a lot of different reasons people seek therapy and just as many types of therapy available. Some people go with a specific symptom reduction goal, such as reducing panic attacks or addressing phobias. Others seek out therapy because they feel as though they have trouble making good choices or struggle to adapt to new changes. For some, it's a chance to regularly check in with themselves. You might seek therapy if you've experienced a significant event that's affecting your mental health, like the death of a loved one, a divorce, a miscarriage, job loss, or a full-blown pandemic that has upended every aspect of your and everyone else's life. A therapist can't fix those things, but they can help you learn how to adjust and how to move forward. We definitely can't wave a magic wand and make this year be better than the fire it is, Haywarden Bradford said, but I think sometimes it can be helpful to know that you're not alone in that, and I think that it can be helpful to have someone give you some grounding. Once you find a therapist, your first session will be what's known as intake, said Dorian Traub, an assistant professor at the USC Suzanne Dvorak Peck School of Social Work. Your therapist will introduce themselves, tell you about their background and specialty, and ask what brings you to therapy. There is no right or wrong answer to that question. Everything is just a lot right now is a perfectly valid reason to seek an expert's help. A lot of people are reluctant to seek therapy because what they're experiencing can feel indescribable, and they're worried they won't get what they need, Traub said. A therapist is trained to ask questions to get to the root of what you're searching for in the therapy experience. Your therapist might give you a survey about what symptoms you're experiencing and other indicators of your mental health, like your sleep habits, employment status, and any drug and alcohol use. These aren't so your therapist can judge you. It's so they can get a fuller picture of you and your life and use that to guide their responses. After intake, which may last up to 3 sessions, Traub said, you move on to regular therapy sessions. Your therapist will typically check in with you about what's been happening since your last session. A lot of what happens then depends on what type of therapy you're doing. Generally, you'll have space to talk about what's going on in your mind and what to process and to help you process what's going on in your life. Your therapist might look for patterns and point them out to you or work on skills to mitigate negative feelings you're having or give you homework to put those skills into practice. It's an open space for you to put your feelings into words and evaluate whether the coping mechanisms you've developed are really working for you. If you're doing something like hypnotherapy or EMDR, your therapist will work with you on that process. And there are several different types of therapy that they talk about in the rest of this article. However, it seems that we have reached our time limit for today. And this will conclude the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, January 22nd, 2021. Thank you for listening to your Sioux City Journal. Thank you.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa. And this article, actually it says chapter 2, is entitled Immigrants Influence Iowa's Food Traditions. Hundreds of thousands of pioneers and immigrants from many parts of Europe and beyond flocked to Iowa in the 19th and early 20th centuries in search of a better life, whether that meant economic opportunity, religious freedom, or the chance to create a utopian society. These newcomers brought a variety of unique food traditions with them and transformed Iowa's culinary history. Some immigrants, like the French Icarians, were motivated by ideological ideals when they settled in America. The new state of Iowa, specifically Adams County, became the promised land for Frenchmen and women pursuing their dream to create a communal utopian society where everyone was equal. By some accounts, their Icaria colony in southwest Iowa was the longest existing non-religious, purely communal experiment in American history. The first Icarian party arrived in Iowa in 1852. They purchased about 3,000 acres of land from the United States government at $1.25 per acre to build their new colony near Corning. Living conditions in the untamed lands of southwest Iowa were often harsh. Log houses, some without wood floors or windows, were the French settlers' only shelter against the brutal winter. Most of the Icarians' land was unfenced, unbroken prairie, and there was not one settler along the trail before they reached Icaria, according to some reports. Supplies for the colony often had to be hauled overland for hundreds of miles. Only a few basic ingredients, including milk, butter, cornbread, and bacon, formed the daily menu. As a communal society, the Icarians worked together on the farms and ate together in a communal dining hall, where evening meals were sometimes followed by music or lectures, spoken in French. Little by little, living conditions in the colony improved as the Icarians managed to establish a fairly successful agricultural enterprise. When wool prices skyrocketed with the outbreak of the Civil War, the Icarians thrived by selling wool and other supplies to the Union Army. While the war ended in 1865, trouble was brewing in the Icaria colony by the 1870s. Much of the conflict revolved around Little Gardens, according to an April 1921 article in the Iowa History Journal, the Pelham Pest. Earlier in the history of the Icarian community in Iowa, each family had been permitted to cultivate a little garden around their log house where flowers might be raised. Some families had planted vines and even fruit trees. Now that these plants were bearing fruit, the more radical members of the colony could not tolerate this violation of their rules against private property. The possessors of the gardens, however, clung to their little plots of ground. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The authorities tried to settle the quarrel with a compromise. As each family moved from their log house to a new frame house, their little garden was to be given up. There would be no simple resolution to this dispute, however, which triggered open hostilities. The radicals claimed that the community had violated its constitution and announced their intent to withdraw. They also advocated an aggressive style of communism and appealed to a circuit court to revoke the charter granted to the community in 1860 on the grounds that Icaria was really a communist establishment instead of an agricultural society, as the Articles of Incorporation provided. By 1879, a group of younger progressive colony members had split from the older, more conservative members. This marked the beginning of the end for the Icarians' utopian experiment in Iowa. In 1898, members voted to end the colony. By then, it consisted mostly of elders who could no longer continue the hard work of operating the colony. The Icarian movement in America was over. The legacy of the Icarian movement endures, however. The French Icarian Colony Board of Trustees was formed in recent years and has been rebuilding the French Icarian village on a portion of original Icarian land east of Corning. The 1878 refectory, communal dining hall, and 1860 one-room Icaria school have been restored for tours and research. History comes to life at the French Icarian village through events like the annual Fête de Mai, Festival of Corn, which is held in the fall. The original Fête de Mai was a celebration held by the Icarians Each fall, after all the crops were harvested, the feast was served in the communal dining hall to everyone who came to help on the final day of corn harvest. In late September 2015, the Creston News Advertiser promoted the French Icarian Village's 4th annual Fête de Mai, which included a 4-course French supper featuring flavors of the Alsace region. It's a modern taste of the French Icarian's quest for utopia in Iowa. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Daugherty Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.